All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Our next guest is Bruce Fine. He was Associate Deputy Attorney General and General Counsel to the Federal Communications Commission under Ronald Reagan's presidency. He is the author of American Empire Before the Fall, maybe that should have been called During the Fall, and Constitutional Peril, the Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy. Welcome back to the show, Bruce. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Scott.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today. The new piece at the Huffington Post is our spotlight article today on antiwar.com, President Obama's Political Sepulcher. That is his tomb, correct?
That is correct. His tombstone, yeah.
And the point being there, the war in Libya. This is the thing, the straw that broke the camel's back, you think?
Well, it's a combination. The war in Libya, I think, is the crossing of the Rubicon into unlimited unilateral presidential war that has brought all empires to ruination. It's just a symbol of the inclination of empires to go to war for no reason whatsoever other than to dominate for the sake of domination, sort of the juvenile thrill of being the bully on the playground. It's combined with his persistence of our troops in Afghanistan. I'm highly doubtful that our troops will leave Iraq by the end of the year because the country is on the precipice of civil war and sectarian fracturing, and it will appear as though all of our hundreds of billions and thousands of soldiers who have died did so for nothing. I suppose if you want to count success as anything, an improvement on Saddam Hussein, that's sort of about the lowest threshold of success you could establish, but it's not much above that, and moreover, our obligation as a country isn't to make other countries free and democratic. That's for their own people to establish. But I say that the Libya is a situation where we really have now a president who, even to some degree more than Bush and Cheney, have engaged in the Orwellian discourse that war is peace and peace is war. Words don't mean anything. And I guess it reached its high watermark when the president, through his State Department legal counsel, Harold Coe, insisted we have no hostilities against Libya because we don't have any troops on the ground and our pilots are not in imminent danger, which I have pointed out, Scott, means that if in lieu of those Predator drones we launched ICBMs with nuclear warheads from the United States to incinerate every living thing in Libya, it wouldn't be hostilities under President Obama and Harold Coe's definition of what constitutes hostilities for purposes of the war powers. But that's just one example of how language has been totally compromised, just the way George Orwell contemplated in 1984.
Well, and, you know, Chalmers Johnson used to say, if you take the Roman Empire and the British Empire as examples, that really you either, when it comes to this point, anyway, this is where we are, where we either give up our empire or we live under it. And more it seems like, you know, the kind of martial law that the people of Iraq live under is the kind of power that's wielded against the Americans. I mean, usually it's the local sheriff's department, but there's still paramilitary forces basically being used against the American people all the time. People entrapped for terrorism cases when they obviously never had anything to do with Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. Impunity for torturers. It seems like we're bringing our empire home rather than like the English did after World War II, saying, all right, well, we'd rather keep our parliamentary system and our basic rights here in on our rainy little island than import the kind of tyranny it would take to enforce the payment for the empire to continue it.
Well, that's right, Scott. It was James Madison who said, if we suffer a destruction of a republic at home, it'll be from the concocted effort or danger of tyranny from abroad. The British, however, I think they had their shriveled empire and forced on them. I don't think their human nature is any different than ours or any other empires. They simply didn't have the wherewithal to maintain their empire. Remember, Winston Churchill said he didn't preside over the British to dismantle the Queen's Empire in World War II. So I don't want to give the British credit for somehow seeing the light. They were forced to accept over their stupidity a wiser course of action in maintaining their parliamentary system and shedding their empire. But anyway, at least they they were finally willing to accept their diminished stature. And to my mind, Scott, the equal, if not more important matter is, empire is tells more about who we are than who we are dominating. And as Lincoln said, he didn't want to be a slave. He didn't want to be a master. We, as a republic, were founded on the principle we did not want to be colonized. We did not want to be a colonizer. We did not want to dominate other people. We did not want to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Our goal was to limit our influence, if you will, by the force of example. We want to perfect our system here with equal protection, with due process, with scrupulous fairness for all of our citizens. Those who would like to win Nobel Prizes are free to volunteer their services abroad in the Congo, in Bahrain, in Syria, elsewhere. They're free to do so. But the government of the United States has only an obligation to protect its own citizens here at home from attack and hostilities. The reason is not because we're callous and we aren't human beings that recognize, for whom the bells toll, it tolls for thee, but because we understand that government never acts for altruistic motives. It always will degrade any effort for political purposes. And even if you think you're starting out on some noble mission, it always degenerates into just power. Politics makes right, and that's why the government should never be in the business of projecting its authority abroad unless we are in fact attacked. Otherwise, we need to stick to our own business, be open, be transparent, make our system as perfect as possible, and it will have an influence abroad, better the influence that comes from the head of a bayonet, which just yields resentments and retaliation against the United States.
Mm. Well, now people can draw their line at Mexico or at the Cold War or maybe the war with Spain or wherever they like for the real dawn of the American Empire, the crossing of the Rubicon and the discarding of the rule of law. I guess I'd really put the real end of it at Truman sending troops to Korea in the middle of the night and not being removed from office for it was basically, the beginning of presidential impunity in terms of the war power. But I wonder if you think that, now that they've ruined everything so badly that maybe, out of the crisis, the opportunity can be taken to get back to the idea that there is a law that binds the power of these people, that maybe we can roll back the empire in a Ron Paulian way because it's the right thing to do and do it immediately and do it deliberately rather than, suffering through the same fate as, say, the Soviet Union where everything just falls apart,
Well, we surely have that opportunity, Scott. In some sense, the architecture of law has remained, untarnished. It's simply a lack of political will. The Founding Fathers expected that presidents would overreach, but they fully expected that Congress would respond, and that if their power of war was usurped, they would respond to that subversion of the Constitution by impeachment, or at least by cutting off all funds for the president to undertake an unconstitutional war. What they could not contemplate is the lack of political will in the co-equal branch of government we call the Congress of the United States. It is turned into an effete, invertebrate institution that makes protests from time to time, but really does nothing muscular to retain any of its powers that have all migrated over into the Oval Office. And they are not going to do anything unless the American people shout and complain and say, we will not elect you to office unless you discharge your responsibility to chain in the president. We don't want to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Unless you do something to stop the wars, we're going to vote you out of office. Remember, members of Congress act out of fear, not out of love for the Constitution. They act out of political fear. And if the citizens don't inject that fear into them, they're just going to go along like they've done so often in the last decade. They'll just sort of wave at the Constitution as it goes over to the White House. It doesn't matter whether they read it on the floor of Congress. Most of them don't understand what it means anyway. Or otherwise, they'll go through the histrionics. But when push comes to shove and they've got to take votes on these things right now, they flinch. I had a debate several months ago.
I'm sorry. You know what, Bruce? Hold it right there. We've got to go out and take this break, and we'll hear about this debate and about possible impeachment of our current emperor. On the other side of this break, it's Bruce Fine, author of American Empire Before the Fall. His new piece at the Huffington Post is the spotlight on antiwar.com today. We'll be right back. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Bruce Fine. He's the author of The American Empire Before the Fall. And his new piece in the Huffington Post is the spotlight today on antiwar.com, President Obama's Political Sepulcher. He may have pushed this empire thing a bit too far. And now, when we were going out to break, Bruce, you were about to tell us an anecdote about a speech you gave recently. Is that right?
Well, this was a debate that I had with John Yoo, who was the one who suggested after 9/11 the laws of the United States did not apply to the president if he stated disobedience to the law helped fight the war against international terrorism. But in any event, the reason for my bringing this up is to underscore how weak and effete Congress has become. He said, I have no reason to dispute him on this score, that when the administration presented the authorization to use military force in Afghanistan and the Iraqi war resolution, the members of Congress were angry that the president wanted them to actually vote on the use of force. And they would rather have them just to act unilaterally because then they could sit in carp and complain if things didn't go right. And they didn't want to vote on the war issue, which is truly stunning. That's why they're elected. The most important decision a country makes is to go from peace to war, which makes what's customarily murder legal. The most important issue to make, and the members didn't even want to vote. And that just is an example of how the United States Congress has totally forfeited, you know, its obligations and responsibilities for checks and balances in making these major decisions and simply watching as the president usurps their authority.
Yeah, well,
but
you
I'd say that Congress is not going to change unless the citizenry is prepared to throw them out of office for their indolence and disrespect for their constitutional duties.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Henry Hyde actually was the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House, and when Ron Paul introduced a declaration of war against Iraq, which he made it clear he would vote against, but he tried to put them up to it. Henry Hyde, who had presided over the Judiciary Committee when it was time for the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, is how concerned your articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, is how concerned he was about the rule of law back in 1998. But in 2002, he told Ron Paul that the constitutional power of the Congress to declare war is an anachronism, and we just don't go by that section anymore. And that makes me actually, it brings up what you just said about the congressmen having their feet put to the fire by the people en masse about this issue and forcing them to do the right thing. And I wonder whether that's all just an anachronism now, whether you think there's really enough democratic process left in this country. I mean, face it, the congressmen need those votes, but they need the military-industrial complex money to buy the TV ads to get the votes. So they're pulled, assuming an anti-war population, they're being pulled in two very different directions right there.
Well, they are. On the other hand, the voter still is the one that goes into the ballot box. And the voter doesn't necessarily have to believe all the blather that comes out on these advertisements that typically are denuded of a single cerebral thought. And that's what I say. Even the money can't necessarily, it has an enormous influence, but it's not always a trump card. Nelson Rockefeller didn't get elected. All the money in the world, I don't think, could necessarily get Michael Bloomberg elected, even if he spent it all on his own campaign. I don't want to downplay its influence. It's still, the American people are not so stupid that they can just be brainwashed. The American people can see how irresponsible Congress is, and I think that was one reason why so many members of the Tea Party were elected is simply because of disgust with what they could see was the sellout of the incumbents there. But that's the system that we've got, and we've got to live with it, and it's really just a matter of leadership. Wherever it comes from, to tell the people, you know, throw the bums out. But you have to be serious about this exercise in democracy. It's not just voting. I mean, democracy is a 7-day-a-week job. You've got to be out there, criticize. You've got to be out there and comment and encourage and persuade and protest. After all, the news cycle and power doesn't ever suspend itself. People will work 24 hours a day to get more power and more money, and you've got to be there as a watchdog to try to prevent it. It may be an obligation that some people won't want to bear, but it's the obligation, it's the price of a democratic republic as opposed to succumbing to vassalage and serfdom. And that's got to be the highest and best good of a citizenry instead of being infatuated by American Idol or the football games or where the Olympics are going to be or what's going to happen with Lindsay Lohan or the, any of the other wretches that are out there. And that those are our juvenile motivations. The highest motivation in democracy is virtue and wisdom. And the process itself has to be the reward. And that's, in my judgment, what we have lost as a political culture.
Mm-hmm. As the restrictions on governmental power have been ignored and all that, as you say, the forms of the law are all still there. Article 1, Section 9 is still there, even if it's inoperant right now. The Bill of Rights is still there, even if it's inoperant right now. And one part of the Constitution that actually exists still is... I mean, I don't know how close it is to the way the founders would have it now, but the fact that there are 435 separate congressional districts, they haven't figured out a way to make it one district per state appointed by the governors or anything like that yet. And that's a lot of little districts for the people to be able to know their congressman, put pressure on their congressman, control the actions of their congressman if they really mean to. And that and it also means that it's too many to control from K Street, right?
Well, that is right, and that's why, you know, virtually all the members have local district offices, and they do respond. You show up in their offices, you write, it could be an email, but anyway, something that's thoughtful and you're active, they clearly pay attention to that. I had my kids were interns in the Congress, and they were a little bit stunned at how closely attention was paid to constituent mail. At that time, it was before the age of the Internet, but the Internet, if anything, eased the ability of constituents to communicate their ideas and thoughts, but you've got to be active out there. You know, power does not yield to anything but a demand from the constituents. You know, give it back. Exercise responsibility. And I understand everybody looks at the bottom of Mount Everest or something and it looks so hard. We're all just one individuals out of a huge cosmos, you know, 300 and some million population. But that should not be a discouraging fact. All great movements begin with just a few people with courage and willingness and tenacity to stick it out without an immediate reward. That's what adulthood is. You know, it's juvenile to say, unless I get rewarded in the next 5 minutes, I'm not going to do it. And that's, I say, it's the price of democracy. It's this price of self-government that, you know, we should be willing to pay. It gives us pride as individuals that we control our own destiny. We don't just have, you know, one person who tells us how we ought to act and behave. And treating us like we're his little or her little minions. They say it's a pride that's not taught anymore in the civic textbooks and in the classrooms in school anymore. We don't have any heroes and those who fought, you know, and indeed in our own lifetime, the civil rights movement just filled with heroes like that, whether it's Rosa Parks or the Freedom Riders or Martin Luther King, the little kids who are getting hosed and cattle prods down in the South. No, that was courage. That's democracy at its finest. It's unfortunate that we had to overcome the racism, but still, the process itself was ennobling. And that's what we lack today. I mean, the usurpations, the wrongs, they're not racial ones so much, but they're still equally wrongs against the people, our privacy, the illegal spying, the flouting of due process. And where's the protest? I mean, and really, it's a disgrace. The legal community just sits there in silence, you know. If anything, we have a former dean of Yale Law School, Harold Coe, the legal advisor, going up to Congress and say, what we're doing to Libya is not hostilities. I mean, it's embarrassing to see these arguments made. This is the best and the brightest out of our legal community that formerly had its honor with John Adams defending the British soldiers accused wrongly in the Boston Massacre, and that was viewed as a heroic effort, even though it was unpopular at the time.
Are you signed on to the comehomeamerica.us project there, the letter to the Congress and the President about the empire?
Well, I'm not sure whether I'm not that. Most of them, to my mind, Scott, are too weak. I mean, if I had my way, and if I was elected, I'd bring home all the troops from Korea, Japan, Germany. There wouldn't be a single soldier stationed abroad. Every one of them would be back in the United States. And all that would, and the pace would be dictated by the number of cargo planes and passengers to get the troops out. No waiting whatsoever. This idea, well, you know, troops should come out faster instead of waiting 12 years and we should only wait 7. I mean, that's ridiculous. We should be out of every one of those places. Yeah.
Well,
you know what would be
now,
stunning?
I'm sorry.
We wouldn't be attacked. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. We're running really short on time, but I do think that this comehomeamerica.us project mm-hmm. is the best hope that we have for a real coalition, real anti-imperialist league, real America First Committee, real hardcore coalition-based, bipartisan, and nonpartisan anti-war movement in this country. I at least urge you to check it out.
I certainly will do that.
Okay,
I will
do that. Because we have to leave it there, and we're already over time, but I really appreciate your time on the show, Bruce.
All right. Listen, thanks, Scott. You have a good afternoon.
You too. Thanks again.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Everybody, that's Bruce Fine. The book is American Empire Before the Fall, and his new piece at the Huffington Post is the spotlight article today on antiwar.com, President Obama's Political Sepulcher.